Watchdog Radio is brought to you by CCHR, the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, committed for the last 40 years to investigating, exposing, and eradicating psychiatric violations of human rights. For videos and information, visit cchr.org.
If you do go to a traditional psychiatrist, they cannot get insurance or get paid unless they put a label for a disease on that insurance form.
Dr. Colby Forman is Dean of Barron University School of Behavioral Psychology, past president of the Institute for the Study of Advanced Psychological Practice, and a certified trainer for the National Federation of Neurolinguistic Psychology. In the last 30 years, the number of people taking psychiatric drugs has more than tripled to 100 million users today. They drug 20 million schoolchildren with stimulants and other psychotropic drugs. Yet there's no scientific basis for all this drugging. And while raking in $165 billion annually, psychiatry cannot point to a single cure. This week's guest, Dr. Colby Forman from Barron University, reveals leading-edge alternatives to psychiatric drugs. Hello, America, and welcome to Watchdog Radio. I'm your host, J.C. McKinley, and we will be speaking with Dr. Colby Forman, Ph.D., shortly. Think of the old image of the lowlife skulking on a corner in a bad neighborhood, offering mind-altering drugs in little baggies, tempting troubled souls with a temporary distraction from their problems at the cost of addiction and dangerous side effects. Parents keep their kids away from the drugs, and society makes the drugs illegal. Look closely, and you will see that there is a certain kind of lowlife on the corner. One particular lowlife on the corner is the pharmaceutical company, selling its dangerous psychiatric drugs under the cover of being so-called medicine. But how can it be medicine when no disease has actually been shown to exist? No psychiatric so-called illness is even described as any sort of physical condition. No psychiatrist can point to a part of the brain that is broken or missing. Unlike a real disease, no urine test or blood test or x-ray can show an illness to be present. There is just the conviction of the psychiatrist that the undesirable emotion or behavior must be caused by a physical illness, and that therefore drugs are justified to alter that emotion or behavior. The next time someone tells you his kid has so-called ADHD and has to take Ritalin, ask to see the x-rays. Pharmaceutical companies have become the legal drug pushers of the world. And now I would like to bring on Dr. Colby Forman to reveal what psychiatry is and what it is doing. Hello, Dr. Forman, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What is psychoneurology?
Well, psychoneurology is a field that looks at the process of using new learnings to help us navigate through life, to be more effective. It kind of contrasts sharply with the idea of some implementing the labeling of some imaginary disease and then trying to make it go away. What psychoneurology really concentrates on is helping us thrive.
Okay, so give me an example of thriving in the sense of living a better life.
Absolutely. Basically, a great example would be something called depression, right? Mm-hmm. Generally, it's funny because about 20 years ago, there was this phenomenal therapist, and I was watching an old video from her, and she talked about this was all kind of the equivalent of CEUs, continuing education units. She was teaching to these other psychologists. And she said, do you know, in the years to come, depression is now being recognized as an actual disease, that they're calling it a disorder? And the therapists all went, wow, really? Wow, that's amazing. And now we don't even question that. The idea in psychoneurology is, rather than working on negating depression, which would make someone try to be focused on being expert on depression or making depression go away, you would realize that there are other things you could do that will actually help you thrive. What's the difference between depression and thriving? Thriving is being able to have the choices and the resources to find one's passion and to do the things that really excite them and make them passionate about their life and what they're doing. So if you, in psychoneurology, we find if we're able to give that person those learnings that help them move towards a place of exceptionally, you know, high states or feeling very good or finding their passion or the direction in life, then we made the kind of diagnosis that was made up irrelevant.
Right.
So, for example, if somebody's labeled with ADD, which didn't exist a few years ago, it often means that there could be a lack of an ability to understand how to use their brain and their focus or their mind to really learn effectively and powerfully and to stay, keep their focus. So by helping them learn to do what excellent students do or what people that have a very powerful ability to stay locked in and focused and interested can do, we make irrelevant the idea that they had a disease in the first place. In short, what psychiatry or psychology focus on, and particularly psychiatry, is this concept called diagnosis and then treatment. And it was based on the idea that you would find a disease or a pathology or something that you didn't like, and then the focus would be to negate the pathology. Okay, so that's basically what you're looking at in psychiatry, is creating a label and then creating some form where, you know, even by the psychiatrist's own admission, what they're working to do is eliminate those symptoms or eliminate what it is they're saying is the pathology. So if someone is perhaps has a particular block, then the focus would be on eliminating the block. And this, by the way, is in contrast to learning and in psychoneurology, where the focus would be on helping you get to specifically where you want to go, as opposed to eliminating a block. So I'll give a great metaphor.
Okay.
You could be running east looking for a sunset, and you may have no blocks, but you don't have an effective strategy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because you can go east all you want, and you're not going to find the sunset.
Exactly. So in my mainstream practice, if I were working as a psychologist or psychiatrist still, what I'd do is I would look at that person, I would say, oh, that person has SDD, sunset denial disorder.
Yeah.
You know, and we'd label them, we'd open up the Diagnostic Statistics Manual, which is this book of thousands of pages of how people are broken. And every year there's new diagnoses that are added, new diseases like texting disorder. You know, if you argue with your sibling, there's adolescent sibling rivalry disorder. If you're oppositional in any way, you have adolescent rebellion disorder. I must have that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
A lot of people do. There's a disorder for everything. So so we would see that you have sunset denial disorder. And obviously Eli Lilly or whomever would have a huge retainer of millions and millions of dollars of coming up perhaps with a psychopharmacological drug that would be there to treat this sunset denial disorder that you quite obviously have. Then what the psychiatrist would do is be working in your processes to help you understand your sunset denying tendencies and overcome them so that you can still learn to feel you deserve the sunset or whatever it is. And through a process of years and years and years and with the medication, that's how they would set about treatment.
Okay.
Now that is in opposition to the way we would have done it prior to all this labeling and this kind of thing. The prior to the way, let's say, ancient people would have done it, or certainly the way we would do it, what we would do is, rather is for the metaphor, we would come and gently take that person and direct their, you know, by the shoulders perhaps, and direct them towards the west. Now they can find a sunset, right? And so we've made the sunset denial disorder, we've made that whole diagnosis irrelevant.
I get your metaphor. I get your model you're talking about. Now, with the current model that psychiatry is using, what are we calling it? The label and drug or label and treat?
Diagnosis and treatment model.
Yeah, diagnosis and treatment model. Now, as you described that, I would like to point out to the audience that there is a piece that they might assume was in the model that's not. And that is scientific proof that when we have the label, we'll use, I like your sunset SDD, where we've made up a disease here, the sunset dysfunctional disorder or sunset denial disorder. And that, of course, is a silly made up disorder, not more silly than the ones that are actually created.
No. I mean, soon they're coming out with one that for people who play Xbox, kids who play Xbox too much. I mean, it's no sillier than that.
Yeah. So,
you know,
I want to point out to the audience that, you know, the psychiatrist is giving a person a powerful drug, which is nerve cutting, a neuroleptic, meaning it impairs the ability of the nerves to operate, a powerful stimulant. These different categories of drugs, which are designed to affect behavior or emotion, and which have powerful side effects, that these drugs are being given, and there was no entry into the world of the physical body other than to give the drug. There was no proof that there was anything wrong with the body that needed to be corrected. There was just an observation of behavior and an assumption that a disease must be causing that behavior, a physical disease must be causing that behavior, and now the psychiatrist is going to try and drug that behavior or emotion away.
Exactly. And I mean, not only do we not have the information, but I can pretty much guarantee you this. If there is a chemical imbalance in our patient's brain, we certainly don't have anything even close to the knowledge or resources to bring the brain back into balance by introducing additional chemicals into our patient's brains and bodies.
That's something to think about, huh? Now, when people are on these drugs, and they've been on them for, let's say, you know, for years, and a person comes off the drug, what are the challenges that the person's got as he is taken off that drug by his doctor, because you want to be under a doctor's care when you come off these drugs?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, one of the things I've noticed is I will often go and work with, I have a number of psychiatrists who will send me their, as a colleague, they'll send me their quote-unquote incurables. And I will sometimes work with, for example, I was just working with a young man who was on Zoloft, Celexa, Prozac, Buspar, and Wellbutrin.
Wow.
And that was his morning cocktail.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was for panic and anxiety attacks, and he was having what we would call a presentation. I mean, very extreme symptoms of fear and that kind of thing. Well, doing things that are, you know, that are non-invasive and not using drugs to work with him, we still help him understand and work with himself and his fears in a much more effective way. And after it was about 2.5 weeks, he'd never had another quote-unquote presentation of those attacks, and the psychiatrist weaned him off the psychoactive meds. What I found was, at this point, this boy is 15 years old, and after spending some time with him, he certainly has the coping strategies that you would kind of equate with a child that would be about 11 or 12. We found out that that's exactly how long he's been on these psychoactive meds, for about 3 years.
Interesting.
So what you're looking at when you look at a child who's been on these drugs that are kind of working into their brain and their nervous system is that a lot of the development that occurs as we deal with life, as we deal with things that are uncertain or challenges that we have, and we grow stronger from these things. These children don't have that advantage. In a way, these drugs are a lot of times arresting their development, much like it would arrest your development if every time you had a problem, you took a drink. And, you know, to make it sound, a technical term of describing this is how you use your brain and your nervous system, which is just a technical way of explaining how you really cope with life. And, you know, your child had the same brain and nervous system that caused this quote-unquote problem, and it was created without the introduction of any chemicals into their bodies. Well, this new problem will only be fixed the same way it was created, by changing how their brain and nervous system is being used by that child. The best that, you know, that we can hope for. You know, I was asked, actually, just as a sidebar, I was asked recently by a psychiatric consultant that I was talking to about work with children. I was asked by him and his secretary, who was on the call too. She said, "Well, you know, Dr. Foreman, I'm real curious. Why not use psychoactive meds instead of these teachings or protocols? I mean, it's quick, and you could just use the drug right away." And it was interesting because even the psychiatrist who was working with her said, "Oh, no, we would always want to use alternatives." That's what he said. And she said, "Well, it seemed like it." And I, the one thing you could do to explain to those individuals, you know, a lot of them are well-meaning, but they don't have the resources. They don't have any other resources but those processes, and they're incredibly lucrative. Is I would say, even if I'm trying to be friendly, I'd say the best we can hope to accomplish with a psychopharmacological intervention, i.e. a drug, is to hinder the brain from performing functions that it's attempting. Basically, you're drugging the person, as you
right.
know, explained. And to date, no one has found in the whole field of allopathic, what you consider traditional medicine or medical endeavor, has ever managed to come up with a medication or chemical that actually will educate or teach the brain to do something new. So what we do, I mean, psychoneurology is just an actual introduction to a new set of processes where we actually educate the patient to be able to use their resources more effectively. So we can create a completely new result. You know,
okay.
Just before you and I spoke, I was just speaking to another young patient who was diagnosed as having a social dysfunction, a social disorder. And basically, this young man had just not developed the resources to kind of what we call initiate and sustain social contact, to make friends and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I wouldn't even get into the laundry list of psychopharmacological intervention that was suggested for him before I started working with him. But I was the third person to look at him. He'd seen two other psychiatrists, and the mother just was not, you know, having any of it. But from their perspective or our perspective, you just either this child had a disease, you know, a dysfunction, and with me working with him, I treated it because we gave him resources. We basically taught him, you know, how to build social interactions and sustain them, or he just lacked the resource, you know, the knowledge, the learning about how to handle these things, and we gave it to him. Well, which one makes more sense?
It certainly makes sense to learn how to do something so you can do it.
Yeah, I mean, to have resources to cope in life, and it's the same with learning, and it's the same with how we use our resources for this thing called ADD,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's kind of a recent invention. I mean, there are consistent things that people that we're calling not ADD do, and we can develop those in any of us. And there are consistent things that all of us, by the way, if you've ever picked up a book on ADD, like one of the famous ones is called Driven to Distraction, I have our doctoral students read that because there's no way anyone could read that and not think you have this new disease called ADD.
Yeah, that's the funny thing about those, that the 18 questions that you're supposed to look at to decide if someone has ADHD. It's you know, or for that matter, you know, in looking through the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, since you're with ADHD, they've packaged common childhood behaviors, put it together and created a disease and said, okay, this is a disease. It fits a lot of people.
Yes. Yes. I think Dr. Zaz, Thomas Zaz, said this so well, that virtually every person in society could fit, you know, very easily into the Diagnostic Statistics Manual at this point. And what people have to realize is that if you do go to a traditional psychologist, social worker, psychiatrist, they cannot get insurance or get paid unless they put a label for a disease on that insurance form.
Interesting.
And it comes right out of the DSM.
I didn't realize that. That's an interesting point, is that you've got someone who is, you know, getting his paycheck from seeing you, and he can't get paid if he doesn't put that label on that piece of paper.
That's right. We can have parents that will come to us or couples, or we could have a child that comes and says, I want to really reach excellence in what I'm doing. If I were to look at that person from the lexicon of ordinary psychiatry or psychology, I would say, like, what's wrong with you? You know, you should be happy with who you are. Why do you have this compensatory need to be so great, right? I mean, it's because the whole approach has to be based on what's wrong and making that go away. So basically, if you don't do that, if you don't say that there's something wrong with the child or the individual that comes to you, you won't get paid.
That's very interesting. And to clarify the, or just to wrap up the point I was making earlier, What psychiatry has done is look at humanity and take every deviation from, let's say, a perfect behavior or an ideal situation and created a name for it, created a label for it, and then gone ahead and give drugs for it. So then all those labels are in the diagnostic and statistical manual. And since none of us is perfect, then it's not much of a step for any of us to be have a label put on us where we deviate from perfection.
Yeah, Richard Bandler, when he was doing his research way back in the late 70s, early 80s, said the DSM, even back then, he said it's amazing because it's thousands of pages of how people are broken, but not a single page on what a healthy human being should look like.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like, shouldn't there be 1,000 pages on how to identify the non-diseased, the non-disordered person?
Absolutely. If I tell you not to think of a white horse, what are you going to think of?
White horse, white horse, white horse, white horse.
Exactly. So whatever we put our focus on is naturally where we're going to gravitate towards. So really, in a very real sense, the world of this, of many psychologists or all psychiatrists is the world of disease, as opposed to the world of mental health. Does that distinction make sense?
Yeah, it's a good point. They're focused on the failure, not on hitting an ideal situation.
Yeah, if you came to me and my entire focus of my mind was to find out what's wrong with you, am I more likely to come up with that than if the focus of my mind was on how to help you, you know, excel or get to where you want to go?
You touched on the receptionist, you know, or the assistant to the psychiatrist wanting to drug the person. And it just reminded me, there's an old joke that to a man with a hammer in both hands, everything looks like a nail. Well, the psychiatrist has got a label in both hands, and he's going to find the one that fits you.
Exactly.
Now, you mentioned that there is an insidious attraction to these labels for someone as an excuse for why they're not succeeding?
Well, yeah, in a way. I mean, one of the terms that's used for it is called secondary gain. But basically what it means is, or in this case, if someone is, for example, especially teenagers or individuals who are always going through that uncomfortable, awkward phase, which is part of growth and development, and all of us are going through life transitions. So, I was kind of joking with you, but it was true. I mean, when I was much younger, if someone would have told me, oh, you know, we'll tell you what's wrong with you, or we'll tell you why you're feeling uncomfortable in your body right now, it wouldn't be because, oh, you're 12, you know, or you're 13, this is why. If you told me, oh, there's something wrong with you, I would have been like, great, especially if you're getting all kinds of reinforcement for it. Now you have a label, now you have belonging. And if you actually listen to a number of individuals that have been, you know, quote-unquote diagnosed, it's as if they feel like now they kind of have a space where they can be rewarded for this, much less getting a pill for it, but where you can get kind of a special attention or certain things. You know, I'll give you a brief example. Because the work that we do is based on where you want to go, it's a little bit like a travel agent. If I were to say I want to go to Texas, the next question I'd have to ask you is, where's your point of departure? And we pay attention to where you are versus where you want to go, which is very different than just diagnosis, which is about a label. Well, one of my colleagues at Cedars called me in to ask me if I'd like to work with this one lady. And so this lady came from a foreign country, and she was a bit nervous, and her whole family was around her, and they had their arms around her and this kind of thing. And she had been diagnosed as having obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to give you an example of what we call secondary gain. When I saw the family around her, I asked if I could speak with her alone. She said, sure. So we sat down and I said, your family's very attentive. And she said, well, yeah, they are now. She said, yeah, they really are. I said, oh, really? Were they always attentive? Even before, you know, you started kind of manifesting or presenting this problem? She goes, what do you mean? I said, before, you know, this came up. She goes, oh, you mean my problem? I said, yeah. She said, no, they ignored me completely. And I chose for that reason, not to take on that particular patient, because what I would be doing if I was introducing new resources and new solutions to her is I'd be threatening the love and the support that she's getting.
You'd be wading through that to solve the problem.
Exactly. And if it becomes part of someone's identity, then it's really entrenched. I mean, how have you heard people say now, not that I have ADHD, or but that I am ADHD or I am ADD?
Yeah, that seems to be the common parlance.
Exactly. So now, once it's integrated into that individual's identity, you're really, by telling them that that doesn't exist, by telling them that that's just a label that's been created to serve certain interests, you're really threatening the core of their identity. So this really serves certain interests, like drug companies, for example, that can now have a market that's linked up, literally, that has this, whatever you want to call it, this neurophysiological anchor, a link to their identity and their product being the solution for it.
Well, let's explore that. So give me an example of that.
Well, a great example would be if you, like I said, I actually, if I went into this, if I would have gone and worked with this patient, and this is something I've experienced from the past, of approaching a patient that has got their whole identity entrenched to this is who I am, okay, for example. Well, hold on one sec. Can I put a sidebar here for a second?
Sure, sure.
Okay, I'm not sure if you're going to want to tape this or not. Is it? I don't know if we want to go to the space of alcoholism, because I don't know if that's really a touchy subject, but for example, people who are called alcoholics or call themselves alcoholics, that's a huge part of their identity. If you were to tell them that addictions and these kinds of things, in a very real way, that they have alternatives, that these things don't exist, they're not permanently addicts for the rest of their lives necessarily, et cetera, these people will just rail because their whole love and support system and everything comes from AA.
You're listening to Watchdog Radio, brought to you by CCHR, the Citizens Commission on Human Rights. For more information, visit cchr.org.
There are different situations where people take a position that it is important to them that there was no choice involved, that this was destined biologically.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, right.
Okay, so, you know, there are, what's it called? Sacred cow. There we go.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Where you can't touch this because it's important to the person or the group that is putting forward this position that there was no choice involved here. This is biological. This is physical. This is disease, as opposed to some choice, some self-determination involved.
Oh yeah, you can't go near it.
Yeah. So with the alcoholism, yes, there is a position on alcoholism that it is a disease. So I would just say to anybody that says anything is a disease, you say, show me your blood test. And if instead you want to switch to the position of metaphorically it's a disease, what I have here is a behavior that I'm noticing, okay, well then let's talk about the behavior you're noticing, and if you'd like to change that behavior, then let's work on changing that. But don't say you have a disease as a metaphor, and then, because then that starts working its way over into a disease as a physical condition that supposedly could be shown to exist, and now you're getting powerful drugs given to you because of your, you know, perhaps originally because of your metaphorical disease, now they're being given to you because of your supposedly real disease. You tracking what I'm saying here?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And not only, I'm thinking about that, and it's also making me realize, you know, much of it also has to do with even the label of what we're calling a disease or an addiction. You know, I had two different patients. One patient's father loved to play Xbox 360, right along with his son. And they played, I don't know, 15 minutes, 20 minutes a day, whatever it was. The other patient that was thinking about, the father couldn't stand it or have anything to do with it. Whether you feel there's any merits to it or not. The fact of the matter is that the father, who couldn't stand it, considered his son, who played it last, to be addicted to it. And now, in fact, there'll be a label in the DSM soon that will confirm that for him. Whereas the other father who played it along with his son just considered that his son liked to play it. So a lot of times when people have a behavior that we don't like, a child can be, I've worked with children that feel a compulsion to study, but they don't consider it an addiction. And so, I think a lot of times even what we get into here is calling certain choices or behaviors addictions or things like what you're saying, that, there's a biological predetermination for this and this person is just, a victim of their biology and this kind of thing. But even, supporting that as they call it an addiction and say you're an addict and say you'll be an addict all your life. And those designations become a very core part of someone's personality.
Yeah, and in the defense of someone that is addicted to something, my personal opinion is, yes, it is hard to break these addictions. So I have nothing but compassion. I don't happen to be addicted to alcohol or drugs, but I've certainly been addicted to chocolate. And so, and people get addicted to food, and a person that weighs, 400 pounds is certainly desirous of losing weight. And if it was easy for them, they'd do it. So,
but what we would call, it might be more effective, if I could just make a suggestion, to refer to these really as coping mechanisms.
Meaning the food or the drug is a coping mechanism?
Absolutely. The person who is, I've worked with a woman who was 187 pounds overweight, and the way we helped her, move through that was find new alternatives, new ways of taking her out of pain. You'll see far more women dealing with issues of food and anorexia and bulimia and this kind of thing than men. And one of the reasons is that women will often process food. It'll become like an emotional closet. You know how you can kind of throw things in your closet that are, when you've got to really tidy up quick and you'll just throw everything in that closet?
Right.
Well, food often becomes an emotional mechanism for coping. And so for taking us out of pain, you'll find that most things that we're calling addictions are really ways of dealing with pain, emotional or, mental, emotional, certain types of, it's usually psychic pain as opposed to just physical pain. But those types of things, and that's, I think, also a potential danger of these, of these drugs that are being used now, because these medications, as they're being called, are actually things that will basically hamper your brain from doing what it's trying to do. So if that child has a defense mechanism and they're, rather than learning a more effective way to use that or to kind of use their resources better, what it'll try to do is keep them from having their brain function in a normal way, because that defense mechanism will then come up. But if it hinders that process in your brain, don't you think it's going to hinder all their processes? Patients that developmentally have been on these drugs during these crucial periods of their emotional and physical development. So you're definitely going to see, you're going to see it in terms of their behavior or their lack of ability. If you put your child on a psychoactive drug, something like Adderall, which is a combination of five types of methamphetamine, three of them would be street drugs in their own form. You run your child through, your child's nervous system through those processes, just in terms of common sense. Because, I think Occam's razor, the concept of one of the simplest explanations is usually the best one that we can look at in science, is that if you put a strong drug into your child's developing brain, and it affects the way they think so that they can't run their natural defense mechanisms, does it make sense to you that if they're on that for 3 years, that's going to hamper their development?
Right.
Of course it is. And what happens is once that child's brain, doing the best it can, or adult's brain, doing the best it can to function, finds a way around the drug so that it can still try to do what it's trying to do, which is a positive intention, what do we usually do?
Drug them again?
Exactly. We increase the drugs, we change it, because they're looking at it as if it were, an antibiotic, and that the bacteria is evolving or something. And that's not it. It's really, you're introducing a foreign substance into a brain that's doing the best it can, and it's going to do what it can to try to still protect or help that child or that adult.
Yeah, the funny thing is the psychiatrist would go, oh, look, the guy's still able to function. We need more drugs.
Basically, yes. And the challenge with that is that it's proliferated to the degree now that it's in every form of society. I was just speaking at a high school, and the principal pulled me aside. It was the second time I was there. I was there about a year and a half before. And the first time she brought me there, and afterwards she said, listen, you got to know something. She's like, 30% or more of our kids are on some form of psychoactive drug. You and your, psychoneurologist can have, we've got more patients here than you can handle. Well, I went back now just recently, and she said, I want you to know it's over 45% of our kids now.
Is this like in a regular high school?
This is a regular, affluent high school in, I don't know if I should tell you where it is.
But it's no secret. You can tell the city.
It's around Calabasas. And it's a very affluent, upper middle class area with really very, per capita, some of the, very highly educated parents and, a very low crime rate and this kind of thing. So, it would be considered a real great slice of the best of Americana.
Just to step back a little bit, there's two options here. Oh, 45% of society is actually physically diseased and is being cured by these drugs or maintained by these drugs, and this is a good thing. That's one way of looking at it that, of course, I think is incorrect. Or the other way of looking at it that I think is correct is the pharmaceutical sales are very effective, and they've managed to persuade society that it's okay to give powerful drugs to people for non-existent diseases. It's not that people don't have troubles, but the pharmaceutical company has talked its way into that it's okay to give people drugs to make the appearance of the problems go away rather than have them actually deal with the problems. If there's something you're sad about, rather than figuring out how to deal with what you're sad about, you'll take drugs until you're not sad.
And when you look at some of the human beings, the amazing men and women that have changed our societies, if you look back at someone like Thomas Edison, that they say unequivocally would have been diagnosed. I mean, he was sent out of school at second grade, or Benjamin Franklin, way back when I was in college and undergrad and grad school, they talked about, oh, well, we know Benjamin Franklin was manic depressive. So obviously they would have given him, psychoactive meds. Had they done that, what would have happened to our Da Vinci's and our Edison's and our Benjamin Franklin's and these other individuals? Would we even have those inventions or those innovations?
That is a profound point.
The work we're doing is so important to us, and anyone who's doing anything like this, we feel is so important, because what we're really here to do is we're doing what we can, because the individuals who are these pioneers or who are going to have these tremendous destinies are almost certainly going to stand out and be looked at as having some kind of learning disability or some kind of challenge. Richard Branson, the founder of Virgin Airlines and, et cetera, was told, he was kicked out of school at 15, and he was told, you're either going to go to jail or become a millionaire. Yeah, I mean, now he's over. He's generated a lot of profit, and he's quote unquote worth whatever that means, over $3 billion now. But he said himself that, that he feels. He said if your child is considered odd, weird, or learning disabled, he said you should rejoice, because you got a wonderful chance that they're going to do something amazing with their lives.
Yeah, I really like that guy. It's like I feel like he. He sticks his neck out and goes for great big adventures in business and in life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. He's absolutely there. So, I mean, what I would just say to anyone who's listening is if your child is having those challenges, talk to us or look for other resources other than, drugging your child. There's much darker examples of this. An individual called me who found out about the work that I was doing, and it was at the perfect time. And he had a daughter who was 13. Her name was Lucy, and he had emailed me some pictures of her. I didn't know what he wanted or what he was saying, or you know what he wanted to talk to me about. But he said he had to speak to me, and it was urgent. Well, it turns out he had spoken with a few of our students, and he knew that they were talking about expanding our work, and I was saying, well, let's develop, what we're doing over here more. And basically, because they were talking about reaching out to schools, and he told me that his daughter, Lucy, at 13, had gotten into a relationship with a boy, and they broke up, and she became, quote-unquote, depressed for a few weeks afterward. So she spoke to the school psychologist, and the school psychologist referred her to her colleague, who was a psychiatrist. The parents totally trusted the school psychologist. She was the authority figure, and she seemed very certain about herself. And so they referred her to a local psychiatrist in West Los Angeles, and the psychiatrist put Lucy on Adderall. And after a few weeks, Lucy said she felt terrible. She didn't feel like herself. They just didn't understand what was going on, and she asked to be taken off it. They brought her back to the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist doubled the dose. They said, well, she's not on enough. By the third month, she started really acting out in school and almost got suspended, and by the fourth month, she was starting to just not even be willing to go to school. So they went back to her at the halfway through the fourth month to the psychiatrist and asked that she be taken off again. The psychiatrist again talked about increasing the dose. The parents at that point decided not to do so. And the father told me at that, you know, by the fifth month, on the fourth day of the fifth month, that's how clear he kept track.
Mm-hmm.
He said Lucy had gone upstairs to clean her room, and when they came in, she had hung herself in the closet, and they found her dead. I couldn't, you know, he said, that really, really brought it home for me. He said, Dr. Foreman, if there's anything you can do to reach out to more people, you do it. And that's one of the reasons behind our conversation right now.
Well, Dr. Foreman, thank you for being our guest today. Is there anything you'd like to leave the audience with beyond what you've already said?
It's a pleasure to be here. And yeah, just the information that there are plenty of alternatives out there and there's resources. And certainly, if you have any questions or if you're wondering if something doesn't seem right or appropriate, you can certainly connect with Watchdog Radio, or you can call me. Can I give my number?
Yeah.
My number is, I'll give you a direct number to me. It's 310-877-2872. And that is a direct number. If you are having some kind of issue and you have some kind of concern, like a child, like this young woman, Lucy, or anything like this, please give me a call. And also, you can get more information about us at Psychoneurology. Just type in or Google Psychoneurology, or go to the American Board of Psychoneurology or psychoneurology.org.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Colby. We'll talk to you again soon.
No, look forward to it. My pleasure.
Bye now.
You've been listening to Watchdog Radio, brought to you by CCHR, the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, a mental health watchdog and nonprofit organization. CCHR investigates and exposes psychiatric violations of human rights and works shoulder to shoulder with like-minded groups and individuals who share a common purpose to clean up the field of mental health. Its commissioners include doctors, scientists, psychologists, lawyers, legislators, educators, business professionals, artists, and civil and human rights representatives. CCHR was co-founded in 1969 by the Church of Scientology and Dr. Thomas Soz, Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry, to eradicate mental health abuse and restore human rights to the field of mental health. For more information, visit cchr.org.